Rabbayim, welcome everybody. We begin Shiur number 27 in a series of 1,000 to come on secrets of successful parenting, particularly where it pertains to teenagers. And this evening we're going to start with a principle that applies not only to teenagers. In fact, it applies not only to bringing up children, but it applies to relationships in general. It applies to human beings as a species. The way HaKadosh Baruch Hu made human beings, they need food, and they need water, and they need air to breathe in order to survive. And one of the things human beings need in order to survive is attention. Human beings cannot survive in a vacuum. Their physical bodies may not shrivel the way they would with a lack of nutrition, but in order for a human being to function properly, he cannot be alone. That's the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the world. Loi toiv heyois odom levadoi. It's not good for a person to be alone. All sense of accomplishment, all sense of pride, is fairly non-existent unless there's somebody there to share it with. For example, let's say you have a child that comes home from high school one day with a report card, and in the report card they are straight A's, and the kid is so happy, and they run home with the report card and they open the door with the key and they close the door. And lo and behold, there is nobody that's going to be home for them to show that report card to. And there's nobody that's ever going to be home. And let's say there's nobody that cares if this kid gets an A or a B or a D. Let's say the kid lives in a vacuum, all alone. What good is the happiness when there's nobody to share it with? Human beings are creations that need to share their accomplishments, the sense of pride that they get from their accomplishments, with other people. And as we're going to see, the attention that people get from others is really what we call their chiyus. It's their life, it's their chayim, their very being. We know that Chazal say that if you're mavayish somebody, kol hamavayish es chaveroi kilu horgoi, it's considered as if you killed him. You embarrass somebody, you humiliate them, it's as if you killed them. We go, anybody who went through yeshiva or Beis Yaakov heard this already, but we don't really understand it. Although humiliating somebody is bad, and it may be painful, but why is it considered like killing the person? Yes, we all know that his face turns white and it's like shvichas damim because the blood left his face and it was spilled, but that's just a pale comparison between real murder and humiliation. I'll tell you, there's a very insightful and beautiful Memra by Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch, which explains this Chazal. Let's take this a step further. Why is embarrassment painful in the first place? Why is it that Hashem made the world such that being humiliated hurts? What did it do to you? Chalila, somebody, their body is in danger, or their body gets, let's say, punctured by a nail. So Hashem created pain. He created nerve endings that register the pain, because Hashem wants you to know that there's something happening to your body. Otherwise, a person could accidentally sit down in the kitchen on a lit stove, and they'll never know that they're being burnt. The pain is a gift from Hashem. It's a warning that something needs to be done. But how do we explain the fact that embarrassment and humiliation hurt so much? Where are the nerve endings that register the pain of humiliation? How do the mechanics work? You know what Rav Shamsher Folhurst says? He says, very simple. Every human being has a survival instinct. And that instinct is placed within a person in order to ensure his life. Everybody has an instinct that drives him and directs him in the direction of life. Uvacharta b'chayim, there's a little voice in his head screaming. And it's this survival instinct that is assaulted by humiliation. Because death, the opposite of life, means a person is no longer around. Humiliation means he's being ignored. He's socially no longer around. He's put down. Maybe he's not considered an equal. And maybe he's not considered even there. He's not choshuv in somebody's eyes. His being is ignored. That's like death. Death is when you are physically not here, and humiliation is when you are socially not here. Somebody makes fun of somebody else, they're not machshiv them. Consider them less of a person, less deserving of equal treatment. You ignore somebody, that's the worst form of humiliation. You don't treat them like a person. So it's the survival instinct, the instinct that tells a person you must live, that is assaulted by the embarrassment. Because we have a survival instinct, that's why embarrassment is painful. That's why humiliation hurts. Respect and attention is chiyus. Humiliation and embarrassment is death. The more attention a person gets, the more chayim he has. The less attention a person gets, the more he is ignored, it's kilu horgoy, it's as if he's dead. Because dead means you're not here. That's what Rav Shamsher Folhurst says. And you know what? There's support for this, I believe, in a pasuk in Chumash. What's the Lashon HaKodesh word for temporarily absent? For not here. When Moshe Rabbeinu didn't return after what Klal Yisrael calculated to be 40 days by the Egel, what does it say? Vayar ha'am ki boishesh Moshe. Moshe was delayed. Moshe was not there. Boishesh and busha are now the same word. It means a person is not there. A person is absent. If you're in a room with a lot of people and everybody's expressing their opinion about an issue and you skip over somebody and that person is absent and you are mavayish him, being absent and being humiliated are the same thing. Being made to be absent and being humiliated, that is. Now, there's an old mashal that demonstrates this principle. Principle meaning that a person's happiness is meaningful only when he has somebody to share it with. Now think carefully. If you had the opportunity to go to the moon and back on the condition that nobody know about it, nobody will ever know, even the person that made you the offer. You had the opportunity to go to the moon and you wouldn't be able to tell nobody. Nobody would know about it. Would you go? It would be meaningless. It would be worthless. Human beings' accomplishments, their chiyus, only exists when they can share it with other people. Now this is true regarding everybody in the world and every relationship that exists. When it comes to your children, it's true even more so. It's not painful when a child does not get sufficient attention from his parents. It's not ki'ilu horgoy, it's mamish horgoy. Child needs from his parents food, he needs water, and he needs attention. And a parent that deprives their child of the attention that he needs, it's as if he deprives from him food or water or shelter. It's abuse. If somebody deprives their child of attention, if somebody ignores their child or even doesn't have time to deal with them, because children crave the attention of their parents much more than we know. And children that don't have attention, their survival instinct kicks into high gear and makes sure one way or the other they're going to get attention. First they try to get attention from their parents because it's something that they need to survive, and if their parents can't pay attention to them and don't notice them as it is, they'll do things to make the parents notice. Unfortunately, it's not that they're, usually it's not positive things. It's very rare, very unusual, and very fortunate if a child who doesn't have attention from his parents tries harder to get a better mark in Chumash and to learn more so that somebody will notice him. Usually that's not what happens, because it's not through encouragement that the child is looking for attention, it's through pain. And when somebody is working as a result of pain, the efforts that they employ are usually in a negative direction. And so, because of the pain, the child will try very, very hard to get attention from the parents in order to survive, and he will do that by wreaking havoc with the family structure, by doing things that will definitely attract the parents' attention. When the parents get a call from the police, Rahman al-Islam at night, we have your child down here, then you'll have time for him. That's what a child thinks. Now, subconsciously, now my father will notice me. Now my mother will realize that I'm alive. My parents, who have no time for me, they'll come down in the middle of the night to the police station. Or they'll come to yeshiva when the Rebbe calls and says, you know, there's a problem, you got to come down. Or when the neighbor calls up with a complaint about a broken window. Oh, children have ways of getting attention from parents. But if the attention that they get is forced through the child's pain, and it's his survival instinct that's working, usually that attention comes in the form of something negative, of something unfortunate, which means that to a child, negative attention is better than no attention at all. Child who has overbearing parents, who have over-strict parents, parents that are overly punitive towards him, that's not good. But it's better than the parent that ignores, the parent that has no time for the child. The parent that has no time for the child is sealing the death sentence on him. Because the attention from the parents is the kid's chiyus. You'd be surprised which children are craving the attention from their parents. I was recently speaking to two parents who were having behavioral problems with their son. He was doing this and he was doing that, and he was cutting school and he wasn't waking up and he didn't come to shul, and the behavioral problems. And the father and the son, mamish, couldn't get along with each other. There was chutzpah, and there were insults that would be hurled back and forth. And I told the parents that I want to speak to the son. And I invited the boy for a Shabbos. And sitting by the Shabbos table, the kid would speak only in admirable terms about his father. He wouldn't say, my father's a great parent. He says, my father's a wonderful businessman. He says, sitting there by the table, and the kid says, there was an ad in a newspaper recently about somebody that won the lottery. And they want to sell the lottery ticket. You know, when you win the lottery, they pay you out slowly. And this person wanted a lot of money right away, So he's willing to sell the lottery ticket for somebody that'll give him more money right away, and slowly you can get the lottery ticket and you can get more money. Now what would you do? And the boy asked me, he asked my wife, he asked my kids. He said whatever he said. He said, you know what my father would do? He would sell the lottery ticket and put the money in the bank. Because, I forgot the exact cheshbon. Something to the effect that you put money in a bank, it doubles every 7 years. And if you have the money up front and you put it in the bank, so then you can get more money than the lottery will ever pay you. Sazah cheshbon. And with pride he said that my father has this etza. His father's a shrewd businessman, this kid's father. And he was talking, you know my father did last time, and he did this business deal, and he did that business deal, and he really knows what he's doing. Now, this kid was a terror in terms of behavior, and a terror in terms of his relationship with his father. But next time I sat down with the father, I told him, I want to tell you something. This child is dying for your attention. This child admires you. This child by the Shabbos table speaks more about your skills than anything else. You know how many children, I tell him, think little of their parents? Oh, my father, he's a useless. He's worthless. He does nothing with himself. He's stupid, I've heard kids say. This kid is proud of his father. Tell him, do you know how many parents would be makane you? They'd be jealous of you. Because your son thinks so highly of you. And he gets older and he has kids. You're Einiklich. What do you think he's going to tell them about you? He's going to tell the little kids, what would you do if you had a lottery ticket and you had an opportunity to sell it? Do you know what Zaidi did? Do you know what he would have done? You know what his Eitz is? This kid is dying for his father's attention. He's dying for his father's praise. Father didn't have enough time for him. He was a good businessman, and he was a busy businessman. And obviously, the fact that the child was so chutzpah, it was a catch-22 situation. The father didn't have much time, so the child tried to get attention by misbehaving, and the father was hostile, he was defensive and combative towards the child. And one thing led to another, and before you know it, it was World War III in the house. But deep down, the child was dying for attention from the father. If you find that combination of misbehavior and chutzpah, together, coupled with an admiration of the parent, and that is a simen muvuk, that what the child is craving, what the child is screaming out for in his own instinctive way, is attention from the parent. It's time from the parent. Parents that deprive their children of attention are in for a very stormy adolescence. Now, we all understand that in this day and age, people work hard, and maybe mothers and fathers work hard both, and then there's the PTA, and then there's the business meetings, and there's all sorts of different types of tirdas and distractions that take us away from our children. At least though, our children, when they do get our attention, it should be quality attention and full attention. A child comes to speak to you, you should speak to them as if you really want to. Because you should really want to. And the child will get a message if you consider him a distraction from your daily routine and an annoyance and you're just being polite. Or you really want to bond with the child. Children know that. It's all an attitude. Time is involved. But attitude is paramount here, because it's better to give a child less time, but with an attitude that says, I really love you, and I really want to help you, and I really want to be with you, rather than giving a child more time physically, with an attitude that says, okay, Rabbi Shapiro says I have to give you time. Here's the time. Let me watch the clock. Let's hope this is done soon. We're done with, over with soon. It's all in the attitude. Now, this attention thing applies to all children. But there are certain children that are in a higher risk bracket for having less attention. The reason for this is, as I said, attention is not only dependent upon the amount of time you give, but the type of attention you give when it's given. So, it's no wonder then, from all the children that we've dealt with and all the problems that we've seen, the greatest risk bracket is, listen to this, girls who are the youngest in the family, who have the next sibling is more than 3 or 4 or 5 years older than them. Sometimes you have four or five children in the family and the youngest is a daughter and there's a big gap in years between the last and the second to last. And if the parents in such a case are older, an older set of parents, those combination of that situation makes for a tremendous risk. We have such a disproportionate amount of problems from those girls that are in that precise position. Girls more than boys, youngest more than anything else. If the next sibling is more than a few years older, and the parents are older people. The reasons are obvious. A kid that lacks siblings of approximately the same age doesn't have the attention from that direction, the camaraderie from that direction. The parents are older people, then, well, they may be giving them the attention, but because they're from a different generation, very often they have a more difficult time relating to such a young girl relative to them. It's a different type of relationship. It could be done, but it needs more skill than if the parent is just 18 years older than the child. Girls more than boys, I'm not sure exactly why. But apparently, girls need this type of attention more than boys do. I don't know why girls more than boys, but that's the way it is. A boy and a girl in both those positions, the girl is a much higher risk bracket. Maybe the boy can get more attention from his peers. Maybe he'll more readily accept friendship in place of the missing family attention than girls. I'm not a sociologist, I couldn't tell you. But these are the facts. If you know of any child in that situation, then that child is automatically at risk. And I'm not saying that every teenage girl in that situation is chalila, a problem. There are disproportionately high amount of problems from that type of setting than any other setting. There are other risk factors too that we spoke about here. If the parents are separate, or there's no shalom bias, and so on and so forth. But in terms of youngest versus oldest, girl versus boy, siblings, in terms of family structure, where the child is set up, this is the highest risk. And it's all because of an attention thing. Parents have to be able to relate to their child and to give them not only the time, but the quality attention that they need. Now we said that negative attention is better than no attention at all. Well, that's true. It's the lesser of the two evils. There are some times where too much attention or the wrong type of attention is counterproductive. I'll give you an example. Just this afternoon, I went to visit the home of a young girl, 14 years old. The principal in school asked me to intervene. She ran away yesterday. She didn't come home last night. There's problems at home. She called me up, the principal asked me if I can do something. So this afternoon I dropped by the house, and who's there to meet me besides the girl and her father? The mother wasn't there. The grandparents were there, and an aunt was there. and a brother. The brother's about 21, 22, college boy. And the girl's 14 years old, ninth grader. And I spoke to the girl, and it was obvious that the girl felt lonely in her house. It happens to be that this 21, 22-year-old brother was the next sibling, and the parents were older people. And it's a textbook case. But you know what? When it came time to speak to the family, not only is the father talking to me, and the brother's talking to me about the misbehaviors that this girl commits, but the aunt is saying, you know, she stays out late at night, she breaks her curfew, she doesn't come home. And the grandparents are telling me, they're adding to the story, and it's all true. All the indiscretions actually happened. My question is, why does everybody know about this? Why is an aunt involved in this? Why are the grandparents involved in this? Here's a girl. Oh, she's getting a lot of attention. And from every relative that they could muster, this family. And they're all giving this girl mussar. They're all lecturing her. And they're all sitting there telling me about what problems this girl has. This is an invasion of her privacy. This girl feels outnumbered, intimidated. All of them against her. It's not enough that because of her position in the family and the fact that, by the way, this was a Russian family, so that even adds to it, because there's a girl that grew up as an American teenager and everybody else are Russians. That itself creates a culture gap that distances further the girl from the rest of the family. And now everybody's ganging up on her, and she perceives herself sitting there in a little island all alone, surrounded by a family of relatives that don't understand her. That's the wrong kind of attention. You ever experienced or witnessed the scene where maybe a friend of yours, an acquaintance, will talk to you on the phone about problems they're having with their daughter? If that happens, the person on the other end better hope that their daughter is not listening. Usually they are. It's the worst thing when a kid knows that the mother is speaking about her to other people, is complaining about her to other people. It's a terrible, terrible feeling. Child is entitled to her privacy, and if there is a problem, you want to go to a helper, that's one thing. But to complain and yak over the telephone, and it doesn't matter if it's to a sister or to a grandmother or to whoever it is, it shouldn't be done. If you do it, make sure your child knows nothing about it. Because the child considers it's an invasion of privacy. It's Lashon Hara. Tell me. Is there a heter to speak Lashon Hara about your children? If you're calling a helper for an aid, is one thing. But stam to complain to your sister or to your brother or to your parents about a kid, that's stam Lashon Hara. There's no heter to speak Lashon Hara about your children. That's worse. Lashon Hara about a stranger is a stranger. But your child who you're supposed to love, and your child who you do love, to do them an avla, to speak Lashon Hara about them, what's the child supposed to think when they know that that's happening? You start feeling that people are ganging up against them, it becomes an adversarial situation. It becomes a tug of war, becomes hostile. It's a terrible thing. And once the hostile situation comes, once that appears, once the adversarial relationship is set up between the parents and the kid, you've dug yourself in deep. So imperative that the child should not feel alone. There's a difference between lonely and alone. Lonely means there aren't people around you. Alone means that there are nobody with you. Well, it could be the opposite. We're not talking about Lashon HaKodesh over here. But there's a difference between a person thinking that there's nobody around as opposed to there's nobody around for them or with them or on their side. You can be in a crowded room of people and still feel lonely because those people don't speak your language. Those people can't relate to you. those people have nothing to do with you, you're going to feel alone. You're going to feel lonely. And so, how many children feel that way in their own homes? Feel the parents can't relate to them. The parents don't speak their language. Family looks at them like they dropped from Mars. And maybe because of the behavior, the parents really do look at them like they dropped from Mars. Maybe the children are acting like Martians. Maybe the parents just don't understand it. If the parents are from an older generation, it's more likely to happen. If the parents are foreign and not American, Russian or European, whatever the case may be, it's more likely to happen. But it can happen anywhere. If a child feels that their parents look at them like they're from Mars, then the child is disenchanted. Disenchanted from the family. The bond is severed, and the child drifts. It's so important to understand the child, to speak their language. You have to use the same words they do. Speak their language, by that I mean to be able to communicate with them. And if they are from Mars, then learn how to be a Martian. Because it's your kid. And it's your job to be able to try to communicate with them. Children crave, they starve for attention, communication, bonding with their parents. And if the parents dismiss the child as being strange or weird or non-understandable, and so just give up on communication, you're just compounding the problem rather than solving it. And I've met many parents that just shrug their shoulders and come to me, and then normal people say, my daughter, I don't understand her, she's like from Mars, she's like crazy. They don't mean insane, they just mean weird, they just don't understand. And that's okay. But what you have to understand is that the chances are the kid is not crazy. And if you admit the kid is not insane, there's a culture clash perhaps, there's a communication gap, there's a language barrier that has to be bridged. If it's a clash, it has to be arranged, it has to be settled. Because if a child is not happy at home, then not only the relationship is in jeopardy, but his frumkeit is in jeopardy. Because if a child is not happy at home, the child is not happy, period. In the vast majority, in almost every single case of problems that we have dealt with regarding frumkeit, child was not happy at home. Now, we're not blaming the parents that the child isn't happy. But what I'm saying is that in almost every single case of frumkeit problems, the child was not happy at home. And you know that if a person is all distracted, if a person is unhappy, if a person feels pressurized, then their frumkeit is going to suffer. You know how we know this? It's a medrash. When Klal Yisrael was coming to the Yam Suf, they're approaching the water. So the medrash, Yalkut Shemoini in Beshalach, says that the Satan came to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and came to the Yam Suf and said, why are you splitting for these people? As Rabbeinu Shel Olam, Loi Ovdu Yisrael Avoy Dezorah B'Mitzrayim V'yata Oysolahem Nisim. Didn't the Jews worship idols in Egypt, and you're making Nisim for them? Hashem doesn't make Nisim for idol worshippers. The Satan makes Nisim for idol worshippers, by the way. But Hashem doesn't make Nisim for idol worshippers. Miyad Heshiv HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Hashem answers to the Satan. Shoyte Sheba Olam, you fool! V'chila Daitam Avduha. Did they want to worship idols? They only worshipped it because of the bondage, and because of psychological reasons. The Egyptians wanted to worship idols. The Jews were anusim. They were forced. They're not responsible. They were shoygeg. He did it without intent. And so the Yamsuf split. Now I want to ask you, where does it say anywhere that the Egyptians forced the Jews to worship idols? It doesn't say that anywhere. The Egyptians did not force the Jews to worship idols. Never happened such a thing. And even if they did force the Jews to worship idols, why is Hashem calling the Jews Shoigeg? Shoigeg means you forgot. Turn the light on Shabbos, you forgot it was Shabbos. Happens, you wake up in the middle of the night, you want a drink of water, and you're half asleep, you forget it's Shabbos, you turn on the light. That's Shoigeg. If the Egyptians forced the Jews to worship idols, that's not Shoigeg. That's either Oinis or it's Ratzo. So what's Shoigeg over here? The answer is that the Egyptians did not force the Jews to worship idols. Egyptians made the lives of the Jews bitter. Egyptians made the Jews suffer. And a person whose life is bitter and whose life is only suffering, that person, how can he be expected not to worship idols? Oines, shoigeg, depending upon how much he's suffering, the person's disposition. Tiruf hadas, that means insanity, that means psychological problems. Jews have psychological problems. They don't have psychological problems. But if a person's life is just so bitter and so bad and so painful and so agonizing, he's going to end up worshipping idols. You need a certain amount of yishuv hadas, a certain semblance of happiness or satisfaction with your life in order to be oyver Hashem. If you have none of that, if you have no satisfaction, if you have no happiness, if your life is moror, and you're an oines when you worship idols, you're shoigeg when you worship idols. That's what Medrash says. The Egyptians did not force the Jews to worship idols per se. But because of what they did to the Jews ended up having no choice, as it were, but to worship idols. Because that's what happens. And I'm certain that there are no parents, not in this room, nor listening to the tape, nor any that I've ever met, that were guilty of crimes equal to those of the Egyptians in Mitzrayim. This should serve as a marshal and as a warning signal that if somebody, be he a child or be he a Jewish slave in Egypt, if a person considers his life bitter and unhappy and agonizing, his Yiddishkeit is in danger. And if a child is unhappy at home, his life is bitter. It is so important for a child's Yiddishkeit that the home should be a comfortable, satisfying, nice place for the child to live. And it's up to the parents to be able to do it. I'm not putting blame on parents if the child is unhappy. What I'm saying is that if the parents can't do it, then it cannot be done. If anybody can make a home happy, it's the parents that can make a home happy. And again, I don't want to lay the blame for every unhappy child squarely on the shoulders of his parents. But there are certainly things that parents can do to make children unhappy. And first and foremost among them is to give the child a sense of emptiness and loneliness, and not giving them enough or the right kind of attention and bonding that children need. I found that those children who in bitterness and in pain say that they actually do not like their parents, it's not really true. They say they don't. They say they hate their parents. It's usually not because the parents are mean or the parents are strict. It's because the parents aren't there, either physically or emotionally. They're just not there. And the parents will come and they'll say, well, it says in the Torah, Kibud Av V'Em. You have to respect your parents and you have to honor them, and the kid has to listen to me and he has to behave. Well, I want to tell you the words of the Rambam. You know what the Rambam says? Yeah, it's true that children have to honor parents and respect their parents. The Rambam writes as follows. He says, Al ha'av v'al ha'em, regarding a father and a mother, Nitztaveinu b'kavod u'mayra, Hashem commanded us to honor them and to be in awe of them. V'al ha'navim, l'shmoy Elohim, and regarding the prophets, Hashem commanded us to obey them. The efshar, and it's possible, sheyechaved adam v'yorei v'yishma, that a person should honor and be in awe and obey mimi she'enoy oyhavoy, somebody who he doesn't love. Which means that it doesn't commit. You can tell a child, the Torah says you have to get your parents' slippers, and tell them that you cannot be chutzpahdik to your parents. But it doesn't say that you have to love them. So when these parents come to me, I tell them, look, you're right, it says in the Torah all these things, but would you be happy if we would force your child to honor you, and we'd force your child to obey you, and we'd force your child to not be chutzpahdik to you? But would that make you happy knowing that the child fulfilled his obligation to the Torah 100%, yet there's no love for you? That can't be forced. The only way that a child is going to love the parents is if there's communication, if there's a relationship, and if there is that attention and that bonding. You can't mun it. You can't demand it. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu in His infinite wisdom did not demand it. If you want your children to be happy, they have to love their parents. If you want your children to love the parents, if you want your children to have a relationship with you, communication, you have to take steps forward. It doesn't come by itself. You take steps forward to understand them, to communicate with them, to bond with them, to give them the time and attention, the privacy, and the respect that they deserve as your most precious possession. And now at this point we're going to take questions. The meaning of the shul is that Henry will take questions from women in writing, if they have any questions, and the men can just raise their hands. Question. When there is a much younger sibling, isn't the problem really that the child received so much attention as a baby, being almost a toy in the house? They become very spoiled and expect this attention through life, expecting to always be number one. Then, when they are older and not so cute, then the problems begin. The stark difference in the level of attention is what causes the problems. Isn't this so? Could be. Could very well be. But all this means is that a child in this, and I don't know, I think teenager, I don't know, I have a teenager, I think they're still so cute. I'll tell you the truth, I don't know, I think they're cute as teenagers too. But let's assume that a parent really, really believes this. And let's assume that this is true, it could be. But all that shows is that the child, through no fault of their own, nothing of this blames the child, through no fault of their own, needs more attention. Either because they're lacking it or because they expect more. It's for sure a combination of both. If a child had siblings their age, they would get that attention. The same reason that the child was like a little toy, for that, the cause of that phenomenon is the same cause of the lack of attention when they get older. So you're right, it's true. Maybe it's because they got a lot more attention, maybe they were spoiled for attention. But because of those circumstances, the same person, ironic though it sounds, the same person that needs the attention more than anybody else, because this is how they were brought up, according to the question, is the least likely to get it because the circumstances surrounding her prevent her from getting it. So you may be right, but it doesn't change anything. All it shows is that this child... You're giving me another reason why the child needs attention. Any more questions? Question. What about sharing attention physically? Until when should you? Is there something wrong if your teenage daughter doesn't like it from her parents, although from siblings, yes? Well, in fact, I understand. My opinion is that physical affection should definitely be shown forever. Doesn't matter if your child's 35 or 15 or 5 or 2. Obviously, though, there's a different type of physical attention that's appropriate for a 35-year-old than there is for a 2-year-old. Can't go over to your teenage daughter and grab her wrists and go pachi pachi hentalach. It's just not going to work. And the hugging and the kissing, it depends on the child. Different children want it in different times. And don't forget, teenagers, their job given to them by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, through the laws of nature, through the Derech HaTeva, is to emancipate themselves to an extent from their parents. Your children will not depend upon you forever, usually. But little babies and little kids depend on you almost totally. That transition from total dependence to independence are the teenage years. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the teenager this ability, which is also due to their survival instinct, to emancipate themselves, to distance themselves, to sever themselves, separate themselves to an extent from their parents. However, teenagers aren't adults, and so they need the parental affection. And that's what confuses teenagers sometimes. And it confuses the parents too. Because they can't figure out why on Monday the child wants affection and attention, and Tuesday they just want to be with their friends. And, oh my gosh, I thought you're craving my attention, and now I ask you to go shopping with me and you'd rather go with your friends. It doesn't make any sense. The answer is it does make sense. Because it's a contradiction. And that's what a teenager is. It's a contradiction. That's exactly what's happening. And it's up to the parent. The parent has to be able to play this by ear and to be able to understand your own teenager, and you have to be able to know how much independence and freedom to give them and how much attention and affection to give them based upon the temperament of the teenager and the type of teenager it is. You have to be able to leave them on their own to an extent and to be able to give them that emotional hugs, those emotional hugs also to a certain extent. It needs both. The thing that parents must remember more than anything else is that those two are not contradictory. The teenagers need both. They need independence and they need affection, physical and emotional. The amount and the type, that varies according to teenager, according to age, according to family, and according to needs. But once we understand that there will be contradictions, and although normally in the laws of nature and laws of physics, a contradiction by definition cannot exist, a teenager it does. I once said that if you want to know what teenagers are made out of, teenagers are made out of Egyptian borod, hail that fell on Mitzrayim. That's what teenagers are made out of. Had fire and water, had fire and ice in the same entity. Two things that according to the Derech HaTeva do not exist together. That's a teenager. Now, you're going to ask me, is the borrowed fire, is the borrowed water, which one is it? The answer is both. So it's a stira, so it's a contradiction. Here, the laws, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the world, a contradiction does exist. And it's no chiddush. They had teenagers in those days too. I'm sure the Jews that saw the borrowed fall in Mitzrayim were used to contradictions because they had teenagers. So borrowed was no big deal. Teenager was like the blueprint for the borrowed. But that's what they're made out of, and that's what they are, and they're contradictions. And yes, if they want the affection, you've got to give them the affection. If they want the independence, you have to give them the independence as well.